We have been, for the last little while, going through a series that we call Dynamic Judaism. The first time that we met, we talked about the question of dynamism, using primarily texts from the book of Deuteronomy, the biblical book of Deuteronomy, which is, in many ways, a sum up of everywhere that had come beforehand, and instructions as to how the religion that was then Israelite, now presumably is Judaism, how it was meant to be continued, how the leaders were meant, were directed to respond to new questions that would come up. So we had the question of Baal Tosif. Never add anything to the Torah. But then, of course, in the same book, in Deuteronomy, it says, when a new question arises, go to the Shoftim, the judges that you'll have in that time. Right? Part of that was a legislative body that Moses was commanded to enact, both by Jethro, his father-in-law, and also by God, saying, take some of your wisdom and give it to the others. You can't be the only place where authority is derived. But that, of course, doesn't necessarily jive. How can you have new responses to new questions if you're not supposed to add anything to the Torah? What kind of added legislation is still sanctified so that tension stays alive? It's a good within-the-text midrash, as it were. That was session one, the question of dynamism. Another question that we started to deal with in our second time meeting was the question of denominations, denominationalism. Different philosophies within Judaism, which each have their own sense of authority, their own systems of response and coordination, their own theologies. And so if we are comfortable with all of those denominations, the question might become, what then is heresy? If you have denominations within Judaism that are so radically different one from the other, and leaders who speak their minds based on their own commitments, what is heresy exactly? So, here's what it's not, and that's the best place to begin. Heresy, at least in our conversation, and rebellion, is not sinning. If we accept a system and we deviate from it, that's not heresy, that's rejection. And the reason why I want to say it that way is because heresy presumes I'm acting authentically. Heresy presumes that my commitments are different from the system's. And so I'm actually not sinning, I'm rejecting the system. We don't use the word sin. It embodies shame that we, at least I don't believe, is part of a Jewish system. There's no judgmentalism that's meant to be carried by a religious body. Nor should shame be the reason that we do anything. But of course, that's a little bit heretical, depending on which Jewish system I'm living in. But here's an example. Here's a story that I'll use to illustrate what I think we're not talking about. One of the first professors of Judaics in the university world, not in a specifically Jewish seminary, this is might be apocryphal, but I've heard it so many times it becomes true, I guess. Sort of like Torah. Heresy again. So the professor was, I think it was at Harvard, and he was known to be an Orthodox Jew, and the Jewish students who were there were so incredibly excited that he was going to be a professor of Judaics. This is quite revolutionary before it became pretty mainstream, as it is now. So after class one day, one of the students, who himself was quite observant, passed by the campus deli and saw the professor eating a sandwich, which by no one's definition was kosher. And the student goes in, feels betrayed, says, "Professor, I thought you said you're Orthodox." And he says, "I am Orthodox, but I'm a sinner." That's not the heresy that I'd like us to be talking about. That's deviation from the norms that I allowed accept. That's me falling short on my own sense of what is right. That's not heresy. The category for that, by the way, in classic rabbinic thinking is a phrase called mumar lehachis. Someone who rejects a system to make you mad. There are countless stories of early Christians or Gnostics coming up to rabbis in their days and saying things like, "Tell me the Torah while I'm standing on one foot." Now the question is that an authentic question? You know, teach me Torah, I don't have a lot of time. That's fair. The other one is, I accept the written Torah, but not the oral Torah, meaning all the expansions, all of the interpretations. So the question is, where does heresy begin? How seriously do we take critiques, both from within and from without? So, Josephus is the first one. If you don't know, he was a historian of sorts. Many scholars today don't take his words as seriously as they once did. But he was the first sort of Jewish historian whose books have been studied for a long time in the academy, telling the story of Second Temple Judaism, telling all of Jewish history before that, and representing things like Masada, which we couldn't possibly have a witness to, because if you know the story, all of the zealots committed suicide. So how could someone witness the story and tell it? But Josephus is one of the primary narratives that we use to derive that sense of history. He used the word heretics, or the Greek cognate, which I can't pronounce per se, or at all. He used the word heretics to describe the Pharisees, and the Sadducees, and the Essenes. Those were all different sects, because one of the original uses of the concept of heresy was to describe a division, a sect, a philosophical party. So Josephus talks about the Pharisees, which became the early rabbis, the Sadducees, who accepted the written Torah, but not the rabbinic interpretations of Torah, and describing the Essenes, but he also used it to describe early Christians. It's hard to figure out what heresy means when you can use it in all those directions from within a Jewish context. I myself am a heretic by Jewish definition, says Josephus, just like a Christian is a heretic when perceived and judged by a Jewish context. So what is heresy? Does that mean place me outside of my own community? A few other words in terms of introduction. Classic Jewish terms for those that we would call, maybe colloquially, heretics, are called chitzonim, which means outsiders. Kofer ba'ikar is one of those extreme sentences in Jewish tradition. Kofer ba'ikar means denies the fundamentals of the faith. Right? And the primary example of that in early rabbinic writing, if you haven't studied Elisha ben Abuya in the book As a Driven Leaf by Milton Steinberg and in early rabbinic texts, Elisha ben Abuya was an early rabbi. We don't know much about him because he's excised from the text. He himself becomes a heretic, maybe that's the wrong term for him, but he denies God and providence. He's a child. We don't know a lot about him, but Steinberg wove early rabbinic midrashim into a book called As a Driven Leaf based on Steinberg's own struggle to rectify faith and reason. He was one of the early Reconstructionist rabbis in the 20th century. He was a student of Mordechai Kaplan's. So, in Steinberg's vision of Elisha, and in the rabbinic text, here's what happens to Elisha ben Abuya. He's a contemporary of Rabbi Akiva, to place him in our historical consciousness. That's around the year 100 CE, 135 CE, somewhere within that. So it's post-destruction of the temple. Elisha ben Abuya is struggling with his own faith, according to Steinberg's read, but he's a rabbi. He's learned with all of them. He's struggling, but he's outwardly within the norm. There are two rules within the Torah that if you follow them by the biblical text's own stating it, you know the reward, and the reward is a long life. Those two are called Shiluach HaKein, which is a very strange rule. It's when you come across a mother bird hovering over her eggs, and you need the eggs. You can't take the mother bird and the eggs at the same time. You must send the bird away. Shiluach HaKein. Only then can you take the eggs. When you do that, the Torah says, you will have arichat yamin. You will live a long life. The other, anybody know what the other rule is that you get a long life for? Explicit in the text?
Honoring
your parents. Kibud av v'em is the other one that gives you a long life by the prescription of the Torah. So Elisha ben Abuya is gathered in someone's property with a whole bunch of other rabbis. One of the people who are there sends his child to go climb a ladder and do shiluach hakein. Go send away the mother bird. The little boy listens to his father. That's kibud av v'em. Goes and sends the mother bird away. Shiluach hakein. And on the way down the ladder, trips, falls, and dies. And in that exact moment, Elisha ben Abuya says the phrase, Ein din ve'ein dayan. There is no judgment and there is no judge. And he is kofer ba'ikar. He rejects the fundamentals of faith, at least as he's inherited them. And at that point, the rabbis put him in cherem, excommunicate him, and change his name. They take his name away. He's no longer known as Elisha ben Abuya, or rabbi, God forbid. He's known as Acher. He's known as the other. He is so not Jewish that he's other. But the rejection of providence is something that you and I might have in common today, here in a shul. Does that make us Acher? Does that make us outsiders to our own faith? So one of the questions we need to ask ourselves today is, what makes someone a heretic in our conception of Judaism? Is there such a thing? Is humanist Judaism, a Judaism that doesn't believe in God, heretical? What does that mean? Now, whereas I would entertain that question, Jews for Jesus is not Jewish. Because it isn't, but that's based on our understanding of what the ikar of Judaism is, the fundamentals of Judaism are. We have a very important delineation between the clear-cut Jews for Jesus and everybody else. There are some who lump Chabad Judaism, Chabad being one stream of Hasidic Judaism, who lump Chabad in the same camp as Jews for Jesus. But why would they do that? I'm not saying that I do. Why would they do that? Because the messianism involved in the worship of Menachem Mendel Schneerson, who was the last Rebbe of Chabad, the messianism that some of the Chabad followers adopt is not so different in that perspective from a Christian messianism. Who has the right to choose? Who's in, who's out? How do we determine who's an acher, who's an outsider? And is rebellion a healthy Jewish impulse? Is heresy something that we would be glad to identify? Do we need to identify it when we allocate Federation funding? Should heresy be part of the question? I mean, these are very important questions, actually, because they have impact. Are we okay so far?
Yeah.
Anyone feel like an acher? I mean, I'm the one speaking, so it's
like...
I would say in some sense it's an honor. I just want to be part of the text eventually. I don't want to get written out. I like my name. So here are a couple of suggestions as to what healthy heresy might be. Historically, we talked about denominations last time we got together. At the Trefa banquet, and for those who weren't there, just a very, very quick sum up. At the Trefa banquet, which means the not kosher banquet, for those who don't know what the word Trefa means, which was celebrated by the new American Reform Jewish body, celebrating the ordination of their first crop of rabbis, the menu was determined by how many violations of kashrut could be embodied in one menu. Right? Meat and milk, pork, shellfish, shrimp, you name it, it was all there.
Oh, yeah.
It was lahachis, as I said before. It was to make a statement. It was to say, it's not, I'm egalitarian, so I count all of you. It's, when we're all together, I have to say, I'm egalitarian!
When was this?
This was in the late 1800s. 1888? 88 or 89. The German emergence of Reform Judaism had similar moments, but this is the American incarnation of that. So, was that heresy? And judging from within that radical reform context, what about what became conservative Judaism? The reformer rabbis, there was no such thing as capital R reform, the people who became the proto-conservative rabbis who walked out on the banquet, which one's heretical? Right? The banquet is heresy compared to the kashrut mainstream, but the kashrut mainstream is heretical to the generally secular Jewish population. But within the reformer population, the small c conservative rabbis who left that banquet were heretical according to the menu. So how many permutations of rejection can we deal with in one sentence? Here's another example of what could be considered healthy heresy. Modern Zionism is a rejection of classic theology. Classic theology, especially in the Torah, the Tanakh, I'm sorry, is about God bringing us home. And according to David Hartman and many, Yitz Greenberg and many other thinkers today, the idea that we are not going to wait for God anymore. We've been victims too long to our own theology and to the world's capriciousness, and it's about time that we took our own destiny into our own home. That's religious Zionism in a nutshell. That God is proud of us for taking this into our hands. That's part of what it is to be a Jewish people. That's not a biblical message. The message of the prophets is God will bring us home on eagle's wings, just like when we were freed from Egypt. And so, Zionism itself is a heresy of sorts. But, when you see today, if you ever go to an Israel rally, like you'll see many people who look like ultra-Orthodox Jews holding signs that say Zionism is racism, Zionism is incompatible with Judaism. Those people are from a sect called Neturei Karta. Right? Neturei Karta is a sect of Orthodox Jews who also live in what they won't call Israel, but live in Israel. They have their own currency, because they won't use Israeli government anything. They don't serve in the army, and they actively ambush Jewish Zionists. Now, are they heretics? They're rebelling against a rebellion. From where I stand, Zionism is a natural outgrowth of a Jewish yearning for a homeland and a Jewish response to homelessness and persecution. That's pretty brazen in the face of biblical history. but it is completely congruent with the history of being Jews. The rejection of that is heresy for modern Zionism and mainstream Judaism, but the rejection of that is actually congruent with an ancient concept of what it was to believe in a home and to believe that God will intervene in history to save us. Which one's acher? One more. And this one's just a little bit more current because it was this past week. I mentioned this past Shabbat that there is a new group of conservative shuls in a coalition called Hayom. Hayom means today. And so far it's 25 rabbis and lay leaders from within their shul. We, thank God, are one of the founding communities. And it's about contesting the establishment of conservative Judaism and demanding accountability. Now, that sounds a little bit organizational design for this question of heresy, but we are contesting the establishment. We had a conference call with the leadership of United Synagogue this past week, with both the lay and the professional leaders of United Synagogue, and they said, we're glad to have you as part of our committee. And we said, we're not asking you to invite us to a committee, we're inviting you into a partnership. That's a rebellion. We can't get written off because we are the shuls that are United Synagogue, in fact. But it's interesting to see that tension in the most mundane of ways with a holy purpose, which is successful and accountable leadership of a religious denomination with an expansive mindset as to what it is to provide service. That's heresy of a sort, actually. Because as soon as you question the establishment that leads your denomination in the public sphere, you are acting in a very brave, rebellious way. It might not be as exciting as a treif banquet, but I wanted to bring it in. All right. Now, there are classic examples in terms of who are the heretics in your neighborhood. And I didn't want to go through all of them, but I mentioned a few of them. Biblically, you would add Korach to that list, Korach, who led the rebellion in the book of Numbers against Moses and Aaron. In modern Judaism, you would include people like Mordechai Kaplan. You'd include Maimonides in his own contemporary world. His teaching was rejected. His book, Mishneh Torah, was burned. Kaplan, who the founder of Reconstruction, his Siddur was burned. He was excommunicated. You would even include Shneur Zalman of Liadi. He was the founder of Chabad Judaism. Because his ideas were so heretical, his cosmology turned everything on its head. We can get into all of those, but we're not going to today. And the most modern heretic that I would point to is Louis Jacobs, who is a British rabbi. He affiliated with the worldwide conservative movement, but he was also under consideration to be the next chief rabbi of Great Britain. But because of his writings allowing the possibility of the documentary hypothesis, meaning the Torah being a human collaborative effort, and his openness to different streams of Judaism, he was rejected. He was even forced to leave his pulpit. So I have a dear friend who followed him in the pulpit that he then founded, called the New London Synagogue. And if you read Louis Jacobs, there was no mind like his in the last century. So the question is, what makes him a heretic? The establishment saw him as outside. Right? So, okay. We're not talking about those people. I just had to. This pink sheet, usually I spend a lot of time doing a text study with a group. So what I'm hoping you'll entertain for now is me walking through the text on the page. We're going to take a break when I'm done with that pink page for some back and forth, some questions if you have some. And then I have some more stuff that I've been planning to do, but we'll see how it all goes. All right, so this pink sheet, I learned from a teacher of mine named Melila Helder Eshed. If you don't know who she is, she's Karen Friedman's cousin. Karen Friedman is a member of our shul, co-chair of the Chevra Kedisha. She's also one of the leading secular Kabbalists, which to me is the most devout religious personalities in Israel at the moment. She was teaching at the Hartman Institute, which is a trans-denominational think tank and learning environment in Israel. She, just a few weeks ago, taught at Kol Shofar in Marin, and next year she's coming here to teach. She is just amazing. When you see an announcement that she's teaching here, please don't miss it. Melila Helner Eshed. So these texts lead us somewhere, but just for a moment, if you hear the words Ha'el Ha'gadol Ha'gibor V'Hanora, right, that's the first blessing of the Amidah, and those words are all represented one after another. Some are absent, and that's the point, in these biblical texts. So looking with me, I'm on where it says the biblical texts. So in Devarim, that's the book of Deuteronomy, We have the first iteration of it. Moses is speaking. Ki Adonai Eloheichem, Hu Elohei HaElohim, VaAdonai HaAdonim, HaEl HaGadol HaGibor VaHanora, Asher Lo Yisafanim VaLo Yikach Shochad. This translation says, for Adonai, your God is God Supreme, Lord Supreme. Here we go with those words. The great, the mighty, the awesome God, who shows no favor, takes no bribe. Who said this? Moses. Just keep that in the back of your mind, that these are Moses' words. Then you go to the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah has these words, Osa chesed la'alafim umshalem avon avot el chek b'nehem achareihem ha'el ha'gadol ha'gibor Adonai tzva'ot shemo. You show kindness to the thousandth generation, but visit the guilt of the parents upon their children after them. Yuck. O great and mighty God, whose name is Adonai tzva'ot. Anything changed from Moses to Jeremiah? They have a word missing. Nora. Awesome. There are other words. I use awful typically when I'm taking time to teach this. But awe, that's missing here. It's only missing if you think Jeremiah had the Moses text. But let's presume that he did. That's the narrative that we're going through. The book of Daniel that no one studies, except it's very cool. It's got lots of dragons. And part of it's in Aramaic, which sets it apart in biblical canon. So the Hebrew, you can read. Here's the English. I prayed to the Lord my God, making confession thus. O Lord, great and awesome God, who stays faithful to God's covenant with those who love God and keep God's commandments. What's missing here?
Mighty.
Mighty, right? Hagibor. So the first one has them all. Jeremiah is missing Nora. This one is missing Gibor. It's only missing it again if we presume that the later texts have the earlier texts. But I'm going to keep on saying that so we presume there's continuity. Nehemiah, which is one of the last characters, the book of Ezra, the book of Divrei Yamim, includes these characters. It's towards the end of a biblical timeline. Nehemiah, I said, O Lord, God of heaven, great and awesome God, who stays faithful to God's covenant with those who love God and keep God's commandments. All right, what's missing there? Great and awesome. Mighty. Gibor is missing again. And then at the end of Nehemiah, Ezra is speaking. And just so I can say it out loud, Ezra is seen as the proto-rabbi. He's seen as post-prophetic. He's a scribe. And if you study biblical history, he's the first one to introduce the public reading of Torah. Because of Ezra's reconstruction of Judaism, Sukkot happens again, which had not happened since the times of Joshua. The biblical text said that. So there's a certain amount of reconstituting all of tradition that Ezra represents. He's the speaker here. And now our God, great, mighty, and awesome God, we have them all. They're back. The bottom of the page is our prayer text that includes the full phrase in the underline. Ha'el ha'gadol ha'gibor v'hanora, the great, mighty, awesome God. But you have the biblical text. So just for one second before we turn it over, because that's where it gets a little bit more complicated. Moses had it all. Jeremiah's missing Nora. The next two texts are missing Gibor. And the final text where Ezra is speaking brings it all back. If we believe that heresy is the rejection of inherited faith. Are there heretics on the page? The reformulation, for us it's liturgy because we daven it, but for them it's the direct experience of God being shared with the people by the prophet. Is there heresy involved on the page? Well, some would say yes. Because it doesn't include all of the attributes. How can you reduce God out loud? That's a heresy of a sort. Continuity is not clear here. Even though there's resemblance. So said differently, here we are together at Netivot Shalom in 2009, men and women studying Torah side by side, about to study Talmud side by side, Jews and non-Jews studying Torah side by side, people born Jewish, people choosing Jewish, side by side, learning Torah and Talmud, a rabbi who's wearing color, teaching Talmud, putting it on the web. All of this is revolutionary at the very least, and perhaps rebellious if compared to a 1,000-year-old tradition. I'm not saying it's innovative for us, but we are innovative for tradition in so many ways. So, that being said, let's flip over the page. I'm going to walk us through this Talmud text and then open it up for questions because I know I've put a lot out there already. So, this is from the Talmud Bavli. It's edited and codified around the year 600 CE. It's the Babylonian Talmud, parallel to the Palestinian Talmud, both of which are comments on the Mishnah. That's the first rabbinic text. If that's irrelevant to you, cool. If that's relevant to you, cool. If you want to learn more about that, Rabbi Carol Kane is teaching a Talmud class as we speak. That's a plug. I saw the nod. What was that? No. It's all right. You'll pay me later. Okay. I'm going to use only the English text, but you can see by the numbers on the English, they correspond to the numbers in the Aramaic, and the boxes should correspond one to the other. You can follow where certain terms are repeated, and the footnotes are just there in case you're really interested. Okay. In the West, meaning Palestine, because compared to Bavel, Palestine is in the West, they taught it thus. Rabbi Gidal said... I should have, I didn't even think about it until I did. This is in honor of George. No, that's my fault. The original only had one D. The Aramaic only has one D. So, all right. The Aramaic doesn't have any D. Okay. Rabbi Gidal said, Ezra, our final text, the biblical text, Ezra magnified God by pronouncing the ineffable name. Of course, that's a contradiction. If it's ineffable, you can't say it. This is on Yom Kippur. Right, that's when we say that one name, and if some of us actually do full prostration in that one moment, when you hear God's entire name, although you can't, obviously, that's when we fall to the floor. It's unexperienceable. That's not even a word. Rabbi Matna said, Ezra said something else. Rabbi Matna holds that what Ezra said in extolling God out loud was, Ha'el, Ha'gadol, Ha'gibor, V'Hanorah. I actually didn't translate Nora on this page, but that's awesome. Great, mighty, awesome. All of that. So the interpretation of Rav Matna seems to agree with what Rabbi Joshua ben Levi said. What did he say? Rabbi Joshua ben Levi said, why were they, the formulators of the Siddur, what we use today, the first modern Jewish prayers, as it were, what did they say? They restored the crown of the divine attributes to its ancient state. That's the point of this text. So just so we can say that out loud. What made them so great? They restored the crown, the ancient crown, to its exalted state. How did they do that? How did they restore, and this is obviously about God, how did they restore God, or our expressions related to God, to what they were meant to be? Here we go. This is where number 3 is in your text. Moses came and said, Ha'el, Ha'gadol, Ha'gibor, V'Hanora. Full phrase. Then Jeremiah came and said, foreigners are destroying God's temple. This is the exile. Where then are God's awful deeds? Where is the Norah-ness of God? Hence he omitted the attribute Norah. He took out the word Norah because of his experience of God and the world. Rather, the world and therefore God. Daniel came and said, foreigners are enslaving God's children. Where are God's mighty deeds? Where is the Giborness of God? Hence, he omitted the word Gibor. This again presumes that they had the original text by Moses and each one took out an attribute. But they... The members of the great assembly came and said, on the contrary, this is the revolution here, on the contrary, therein lie God's mighty deeds. There's the giborness. Why? God suppresses God's wrath. That takes might. Might is not seeing our enemies crippled, crushed, defeated. Might is God not doing that. God extends long-suffering to the wicked. And here is God's awesome powers. Here's God's Norah-ness back at Jeremiah. But for the fear of God, how could one nation persist among many? It's not if God's awesome, we always win. It's we're surviving. How else can you explain it other than God is awesome? Now, we could talk about the Odyssey for a long time. But here's the punchline. That's where number 5 is. So how could the earlier rabbis, by the way, the earlier rabbis here are Jeremiah, Daniel. I love that. But anyway, even Aramaic sounds great. It says, it's like the alliteration. How could the earlier rabbis abolish something established by Moses? Rabbi Elazar said, since they knew that the Holy Blessed One is truth, they would not ascribe false things to God. Since they believed that God demands truth, they couldn't lie about what they believed. Is that heresy? Is their taking out an attribute of God as preordained, pre-established, by Moses, heresy? Judged by the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the people of the Great Assembly, was it heresy what they did? Judged, and this is the meta level, judged by the Talmud, our text, judged by the Talmud's perspective, was the revolution embodied by the phrasing heresy? And I would say not by our punchlines judgment. By the punchlines judgment, the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah were heroes. The people of the Great Assembly were heroes. Why? Because they reestablished the luster of God's crown. But were the early rabbis, meaning Jeremiah and Daniel, were they heretics? No, they were honest. And their description of God shifted because they were honest. So we don't have their changes, their emendations in our text as we daven today. But what did they do? They told the truth about what they saw. And why? Because in the Hebrew, God is amiti. God is true, truthful, honest. So we're going to take a pause for now in terms of looking down. It's a lot up in the air. I want to give us a chance to reflect a little bit. All right.
How would the rabbis interpret it if Daniel and Jeremiah said, Logibor?
Oh, okay, good. So it's anyone's question. For those who didn't hear, are asked, how would the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah or the Gemara authors, editors, how would they have looked at it if Jeremiah and Daniel would have said out loud the opposite,
yeah.
Right? God is not great.
Yeah.
Right? That's the name of a book by Christopher Hitchens.
Yeah.
Right? So I think that would have been a more radical kind of revolution. In fact, Joseph Ellis, who is a wonderful American historian, in a book called American Creation, describes the innovative spirit of the founding fathers as the ability to create an evolutionary revolution. He says that what they were able to do is they shifted the mindset in a radical way without it feeling like a break. And so if we presume that Jeremiah and Daniel had the original Moses text, and instead of saying God is not great, what they did is they took out that word so they could continue with the general feel of the thing, then what they did was gentler than what you were suggesting could have happened. I think the rabbis would have had a harder time with an outright rejection.
But I think this is a very important nuance, but I wouldn't have said or thought what you said it wasn't heretical because it was true for them. I would have thought it wasn't heretical because it wasn't God's words, it was Moses' words. And what, I mean, Moses, you all know, but...
So for those who didn't hear, it's a good question. The question is, perhaps it wasn't heretical because it wasn't God's word, it was Moses' word. Just to point out, that presumes that Moses' word in the Torah isn't God's word. There are many who would see the two as quite the same. Because once Moses attests to something in the Torah, it's truth. For those who see the Torah as, you know, not contestable. And so, even if it's, quote, only heresy in the context of history, and not involving God's manifest word, that still is a heresy of sorts, but less egregious. So I think your question is very important. Some would have a very quick answer to it, which is to say there's no difference. But contesting historical precedent when it comes to faith is itself quite potent. So I would keep the question alive, even in the reformulation.
I think at one time Moses is quoted several times with different kinds of words, and always a question arises, was it exactly spoken the way it was supposed to be? I think I kind of remember there were questions about when he was quoting God in different places with different words.
Yes, I'll give you the most extreme example, but we're going to hold that question live because it's a great segue to where I'm at least planning for us to go. One of the big differences in the Torah's text between when we see God's word and then Moses' interpretation of God's word as presented to the people is in preparation for Sinai. God says to Moses, tell the people to get ready for 3 days, wash their clothes, get ready. Moses adds to it, don't come close to a woman. In that very not-so-simple difference, we see the human adulteration of God's word. What David Weiss Halivni, a postmodern Talmud scholar and theologian, calls the maculate word. Right? It's not immaculate. It becomes adulterated. It becomes corrupted by human transmission. So let's keep that question alive for a moment. Other questions? Michael?
It seems the last line there that pushes heresy out of harder, because if you say something that you believe is truth in your own time, it's not heretical. If you're saying something just to tweak the establishment, I remember doing that when I was younger, just something to that can be heretical. Right. If you're actually standing in a position of truth for yourself, then it's not heretical. That means a lot of people can stand in their own position of truth and not be heretical.
I think that's true. The intent of the heresy, of the pushing, is really, really important here.
Right. It comes down to arguing for the sake of heaven.
Yes, exactly right. The Jewish response to the question of heresy is, why are you doing it? If it's l'shem shemayim, for the sake of heaven, then it's a righteous shift. But who judges whether or not it's for the sake of heaven? Right? Because within my experience as a conservative rabbi, arguing for gay inclusion has been seen by different people as either one of those. Either you just want to shtuch the establishment, is the Yiddish way of saying it. You want to push it so hard that you can prove that you're there, right? Which is potentially one of the reasons that I'm so committed to it, because I like knowing that I'm here, but that's not a good enough reason. If I'm doing it because I think it's right, if it's amitihu, if it's part of an honest divine encounter, then it's right to do. Ego is not a good reason, and I'm talking about me, not you. Ego is not a good enough reason to be an advocate. But within a religious establishment, believing that an honest spiritual framework has to be different than the one that we've inherited is potential. I want to call Claire and then I'll look back at you, Matt.
I'm having trouble grappling with the concept of heresy because it's been used so much to exclude people.
Right.
And to draw narrower and narrower and more rigid lines. And
right.
I don't think that's what we're about. And yet, you know, this little discussion here clearly went on an intellectual level, but there's other levels where it just rubs me the wrong way completely. Why
right.
Do we even have to be having this conversation?
No, I hear you. I hear you. In the American context, words like liberal and conservative have come to mean the same thing as heretic. But I actually think that this exists all the time. The word orthodox for some means that, the word reform for some means that. And I actually think the conversation is important, not because we as a shul, let's say, a shul community, are going to suddenly have a category called mumar, you know, heretic or lahachis, you're here just to annoy. You know? Yeah, exactly. We'll have an email list, Netivot Shalom Mumars. But I think the question is actually more helpful when it comes to our confrontation that we initiate with, let's say, the conservative movement. I mean, part of what my agenda is in having this conversation is recognizing that affiliation with a larger group called a denomination can actually be redemptive. It's not just functional. Because if we see the encounter with God or Jewish community, and for me those are actually quite similar, though Jewish community is only partial as an encounter with God, at least in my theology, if we see the encounter with God as healthy, purposeful, and redemptive when communicated well, when seen beyond the boundary of our own shul wall, right, and we feel like we're learning that and we can teach that, then the conservative movement with whom we exist organizationally, the give and take can lead to the abolishing of the concept of heresy and the re-understanding of it as redemptive advocacy in a healthy religious way. So I actually think it's quite relevant, because what I'm trying to not do is read anyone out. Like, that's why I'm not using the word sinning, because I think that's not living up to my accepted ideals. Heresy, I think, has actually gotten a bad rap. And we'll look in a moment at a few places where it's been used in the disturbing way. But my hope, and I'm just speaking about me, my hope is that in the question of dynamic Judaism, there is room for growth, there is room for change, there is room for that conversation without automatically labeling someone who disagrees with you as an outsider. We need to have a codified text where no one is labeled acher in order to truly be a community. But then, of course, there are times where someone needs to be, not someone, but an idea needs to be ruled out because it is not possible in an authentic Jewish conversation to believe in Jesus. It isn't. And that's a clear one to point to, but there are many others that are not so clear. And there do come questions sometimes. I have never, when someone comes to me and says, I'm curious about your community, said to them, all right, can you tell me what you believe before we begin the conversation? Can you tell me if you observe this way before we begin the conversation? That's not at all the approach that we have as a community embodied in a rabbinic encounter with someone. But when we're having events and someone says, can you tell me whether or not I can prepare something in my own kitchen to bring it to shul, I say we have a kashrut policy and that's how we do it. So the idea is actually sometimes the question. What ideas are not evil but not congruous with our aspirations as a spiritual home? So I actually think the question is quite alive. The delivery of the conversation, the delivery of structure, is very difficult. Because once we say, this is who we are as a shul, people can feel pushed away. Someone walks in, a teenager coming to a bar bat mitzvah, walks in with, you know, playing Game Boy, or playing with their cell phone, texting somebody, or is in the sanctuary texting somebody. What's the right way to say, we love you? We don't do that here. You know, it's actually the same as saying, please don't eat on our stairway. That's not a respectful way to, you know, to exist on Shabbat. We need to be able to walk up and downstairs, and we want to treat our custodians with dignity because they have to get that junk out of the carpet if it's there. A legal procedure embodying purpose without trying to rule someone out. So I hear you.
The history, at least of my family, is the grandparents and great-grandparents came from schools where they were always saying, so-and-so doesn't observe this, so they're bad, and they aren't really members of
schools. All right, so the question of, you'll see how this works together, the question of judging someone publicly or privately because they don't conform, and the question of whether or not the biblical text is an actual report of God's will, they will be part of our first text once we look at the next sheet. Okay. So I told Matt I would come back to him.
So my question is, you just spoke about how you're trying to see movements in conservative Judaism in particular as a place of hope for inclusion. My question to you would be, isn't denominationalism the villain here? I mean, isn't denominationalism the one who's curling these world words of heresy? So by operating the text as a denomination, I don't want to say it's a losing battle, it's just falling at all. I'm not criticizing because I share your same hope, but is it even possible in a denominational context?
Right. Denominationalism is not worth saving if, in the name of denominationalism, I tell you that you are wrong right now. The hope that I have for denominationalism and conservative Judaism in particular is because I believe they are groups of people that come together for purposeful things, that have a trajectory that's sacred. That is a very different conception of denomination than the one that is established when those denominations historically came to being. So actually what I'm arguing for is a revolution in the concept of denomination. They are not the villain, just like tradition is not the villain. And yet, if you read, what's the book? Infidel. What's the author? Hersey is her last name?
Yeah, Kirsten
Ali. Ali, thank you. When Judaism, when religion is used to hurt, and in the extreme of that, to murder, right, in the name of God, that's also religion as the villain. So I think any framework can be manipulated. There's an imam in Oakland who I was on a panel with at the Dominican school just a month ago, and he said, before he even began, because he knew he would have to say this out loud, he said, I just want to say out loud that the terrorists in 9/11 were acting in rage and not acting in Islam. And the delineation between the two is quite important, because religion goes wrong, and denominations go wrong, and families go wrong, and organizations go wrong when the mission is not allowed to be healthy and breathing and accountable to a human experience. That's why I chose that text where Jeremiah and Daniel shift Moses' words, even if they didn't, even if the books came into being by their own. In the Talmud's estimation, they said God, an experience of God has to be honest. I can't say that anymore. Right? There are plenty of things in a Jewish context that are the same. We say the Aleinu. Right? If you've ever read a literal translation of the Aleinu, you might not say it again. Especially with a sentence that's a quote from Isaiah, which has been excised. The quote from Isaiah said, "Shehem yishtachavim lahevel varik." They bow down to spit and nothingness, and pray to a God who will not save them. Who took that out of the Siddur? Christian censors. And some Orthodox Siddurim have it back in parentheses. So what does it mean? It means that religion, when it is static, as opposed to dynamic, is the villain. Denominations are the same. Any framework which refuses to adapt, I think, turns into a very dangerous weapon. Clark.
You talked a little bit about, in terms of the Rabbinic tradition, the want between innovation and mercy, because
right.
If you think, for instance, of the rabbis at Yom Kippur, such as the sacrificial prayer, that's tremendous mercy and innovation. What is the rabbinical tradition,
where is
there a rule,
implicit
rule,
what? There were a couple of red lines that were clear, that if you crossed them, you were no longer within. So one of the clear lines for the classic rabbinic system, I'm not talking about modern Judaism, the classic rabbinic system was questioning the divinity of the Torah, was questioning God's existence, though that word actually didn't have any meaning, God's providence in the world. So if you don't believe that God is in charge, and you don't believe there is ultimate judgment, and you don't believe that the Torah is divine, you're out. There were those, there's a blessing in the weekday Amidah called the Lamal Shinim Al Tihi Tikva. And to the, whatever the Mal Shinim are, there should be no hope. That's a replacement word. The original word was Minim. It means to the sectarians there should be no hope. So in the central, three times repeated prayer, there was a hope that those who would report Jews who didn't pay taxes to the Roman authorities, that was the minim also. Lamal shinim is the actual translation of that. It means informers. Right? There are those who throughout history have been led into this acherness, into this outsiderness. But the lines that are clear are very few. So for instance, and I'm not jumping the gun because I want to take whatever questions we have left in a minute or two, Spinoza is the classic example of the one who gets written out. Why? And here's where the two comments come together. Because he contested whether or not the Torah was written by God out loud, and believed in God, but the God that Spinoza believed in, it was panentheism. It was belief that all is within God, and God isn't, you can't point to God as separate from the world. It's not pantheism, it's panentheism, that everything is within God. He was excommunicated by his community in Amsterdam because of that perspective. So, in the rabbinic concept, if you reject classic belief, you're out. Okay, so the different question is, what does innovation mean? If innovation is me adding to the system, well then we have a two-word phrase that tells me not to do it. It's called Baal Tosif. It's in the book of Deuteronomy. I can't explicitly add anything to Torah, to the system of Judaism, except that there is a concept. Abraham Joshua Heschel has a book about this where he contests whether or not this was always believed to be true. His book is called Asbaklaria. Torah Min HaShemayim Basbaklaria Shel Adorot. It's translated by Gordon Tucker into a book called Heavenly Torah. It's a mammoth volume and really beautiful. So the concept is that even the innovations that have been introduced in modern houses of Jewish study, those were all given at Sinai. So it's not innovation, actually. It's the manifestation of latent truth.
More later.
I mean, there's no complete answer to your question. Yeah.
I feel a lot of what we might define as heresy is really socially constructed even more or just as much as theologically constructed. So I look at these rabbis looking at these texts. They start with the premise that Daniel and Jeremiah are heroes. They're going to find a way that they're not heretics. That,
right.
So it's almost the logic may be in reverse. And I think what goes on a lot today in terms of most of the things you see where I guess some might still be heresy, but outside are no good, is still socially constructed. What one of my teachers calls the fat factor. The fat factor changes over time. So you mentioned at the beginning, here I am teaching men and women together. For most Jews, perhaps still a few not, but for most Jews today that's not fat.
Right.
But a couple generations ago, for sure it was fat. And I'm thinking about a quick story. In my experience, I led several years with a fellow student meditation retreat, a Jewish meditation retreat, at my rabbinical school. And one time, the partner of the only Orthodox member of the faculty asked me, all she said was, well, what do you do at the retreats? But I was a little bit defensive because of her background. I thought maybe she's going to do it. So I went into this long Jewish support for the practice. And it turned out she was reassured just by finding out that we chanted in Hebrew and spoke about Jewish-themed things when we spoke. She had envisioned a group of people sitting in lotus position chanting poems. Although my teaching partner probably could, I probably actually couldn't sit in lotus position. And I thought about it much later. That was cool, so that's not terrible. There's nothing, what would be terrible about sitting in lotus position if you could?
And even though you and I agree, I think, in many ways about this, the response is also quite clear if we were to take that position. It is heretical because you're not davening.
Right.
I think you are davening, but the response was
davening. The chanting and the silence, as long as it was in Hebrew and in a Jewish
way. I'm going to call you on your sentence. She, who is teaching you in rabbinical school. Right? That's heretical for some.
Her husband was a teacher, but she... He was probably interesting because he was the one Orthodox member of the faculty.
Right.
Was like represented Orthodox.
Right.
In his community, he was a serious weirdo because he taught it.
So heresy can go anyway, right? I want to agree with you. I'm going to use you as a segue into one of the texts that's on the yellow page. We're not going to do all of them. Text number 4 is by Chancellor Arnold Eisen. He's a chancellor of JTS in New York. Are there extra yellow sheets for anyone who needs?
Yes.
In the back, okay. So this is in a book called Rethinking Modern Judaism from 98. It's a very hard book, but really, really beautiful. He says, transformation of practice in the name of tradition is now utterly commonplace and need not be elaborately explained or justified. I don't need to explain a meditation minion in a Jewish context. It has become more problematic, however, because the task must be accomplished without Mordechai Kaplan's faith, he's critiquing Kaplan here, in objective science, which Kaplan believed in, that science was true, and that assertions of science were absolutely true. Historical progress, which Kaplan also believed was absolutely true. Or the authenticity of modernity. And also without, and this is more important for us, without Kaplan's hope for the sort of all-encompassing community that would have made the argument in favor of tradition, however reconstructed, unnecessary. Which means Kaplan believed that in Kaplan's reality, he had to argue that change was authentic. That dynamism, that's the name of a collection of his writing, Dynamic Judaism, that's why I chose the title, that dynamism had to make the argument to be legitimate. And in fact, what Eisen says, and I believe this to be true as well, is that the opposite is harder now. It is much harder now to make the argument for tradition, since there are many alternative authentic traditions. How do we argue for kashrut in the same shul where we argue about permeable boundaries? How do we argue for traditional liturgy when we feel differently about God? It's harder sometimes to read the English part of the Siddur than it is to do the Hebrew if you don't speak Hebrew. The Hebrew is much more comforting because it's not as familiar and I don't necessarily know what I'm saying. That's really interesting. And yet we affirm the place of traditional liturgy. Even while our translations are different. So that Elena that I mentioned before, right? Shelo sam chalkenu kahem. The Hebrew of that says, God, you didn't make our portion like theirs, us and them. What does the English translation and the Sim Shalom say? You gave us a unique destiny. Quite similar, but not the same. So why is that? Because we want to maintain tradition in the face of shifting conviction, shifting sense of what is amiti, what is true. There are people who, when they say the bracha, upon receiving an aliyah to the Torah, the traditional one is Asher Bacha Banu Mikol Ha'amim, God who chose us from all other peoples. The reconstructionist and renewal permutation of that first blessing, some of it has it, Asher Bacha Banu Im Kol Ha'amim, God who chose us with all of the other nations. Right? It's just the addition of the letter Ayin. But what a letter that is. And it sounds actually quite similar. If you're listening and someone says it quickly, you don't know that there's difference. So it's traditional, but it's not. So the argument in favor of tradition now needs to be made. That's why heresy is such a weird word to use in a modern, a postmodern context. What's heresy when there are multiple truths? Well, the answer is, sometimes there is such a thing still. It might not be called heresy, it's just not who we are. Well, who's we? And who determines who is we? How do you do that authentically? So I'm not going to look at the first text on the yellow page. That's Spinoza's, the preamble of Spinoza's Excommunication. If you don't know his stuff, he was very, very interesting. In reviewing, I remembered he died when he was 44. And he died from inhaling the residue of glass because he was a lens polisher. Once he was excommunicated, he went back to being a lens polisher. Some of his books were published after he died, some classic ones, but that which made him excommunicated was that he relied on a commentator named Ibn Ezra who suggested that some of the Torah's texts could not possibly be Moses' words because they were written after Moses' death. So even though there are traditional responses to that, which said God did dictate those words to Moses, and Moses wrote them down crying. That's a traditional response. There is also the concept that Joshua finished it. There is also the concept, according to Ibn Ezra, as articulated by Spinoza, that Ezra, the scribe, who we just read a text from, Ezra was the one who wrote the Torah. Well, that was one of the main reasons that he was excommunicated. Right? And he was reviled by both Christians and Jews because it was so heretical to suggest that God wasn't the author of either the Torah or the Old Testament, as the Christians would have called it then. I'm not going to do text 2. That's by Judith Hauptman, who's a rabbi and a professor of Talmud at JTS. It's a fascinating question as to what the role of rabbis are. But I want to look at Jonathan Sarna. That's text 3. For those who don't know, he's a wonderful author and teacher. He was actually on the inaugural panel of Chancellor Arnold Eisen, along with Ann Swidler, who's in our community. He's an American historian par excellence, American Jewish historian par excellence, and he has a lot of wonderful writings. This is in a book called A Great Awakening.
Can I just ask a quick question?
Yeah.
What's the last time historically that any Hebrew wording in our symbol was changed or altered?
Yesterday. Today. One of the most modern innovations in terms of the Siddur language is what we take for granted, although we don't take it for granted because we have to say it's on page 156B. That letter B tells you that it's innovative, right? It also tells you that the establishment wasn't entirely comfortable but also couldn't write it out. One day we should have one page of the Amidah that includes the Imahot and no page that doesn't. But it tells you that change. Yes, Kol Yoshe Tivel actually is an even more modern innovation for our shul, though it's not new by any means, and so that's why it's not even on the page. That's why when people are reading the text, if you have been to Nitivot many times, you know that we add about Kol Yoshe Tivel. We don't just pray for peace for Jews, right? We pray for peace for the whole world. But if you are new to Nitivot Shalom, you don't know that those two words are coming. You expect the Amen two words earlier, and you're lost or you feel dislocated. It's quite interesting. And then those who are from Nitivot, and you're doing it during learning instead of services, you wonder, we want to be inclusive. Should we throw somebody off by adding words in that aren't there? Oh, really? Well, that's interesting, because that's self-determined. Not outsider, but this isn't who I am. And the change is seen then as unacceptable. Very interesting.
Because 59 months ago when I asked him, he said, when did we start rewriting our Siddur? And he said, let's give it a couple of years first.
Yeah.
A couple of years is up.
To be honest, I think, to respond in all seriousness, I think that the challenge is not rewriting the Siddur. The question is making it accessible as it is. so that the entire community can join in the conversation as to any potential changes. Right? Many of the changes that have taken place are the most radical, which are the removal of the words V'ishe Yisrael. We don't pray for the restoration of fire sacrifices. I actually include the words V'ishe Yisrael whenever I daven because I don't see them as literal sacrifices. I see them as fiery offerings of who we are. There are ways to use a traditional language and mean something radically different. And so until we as a community can own the Siddur, I think changing it is premature. That's actually why I say give it some years. We need to own our current davening life in order to believe authentically that we have a voice and it's shifting. That's, to be honest, that's my underlying message throughout this whole series, which is to say what Eisen is saying. Dynamism is taken for granted. There are multiple possible legitimate truths. We need to find a way to advocate for our own sense of what is right, which means that we need to understand and own and be tradition in order to shift ourselves. We'll talk more, I'm sure. Sarna says this. This is text 3. He's an academic in Boston, too. Continuity may depend upon discontinuity. Some of the late 19th century Jews' most successful and creative innovations, notably their emphasis on religious particularism and on Zionism, turned past wisdom on its head. New historical conditions created new movements, new emphases, and new paradigms, the very opposite of the tried and true. Today, we too must be willing to challenge some of our most basic assumptions. Even as we support and must support the so-called community agenda, it bears remembering that discontinuities, at least the right sort, may have a greater impact still. So what is one of those? Well, one of them might be the Hayom Coalition in terms of what it means to be a conservative movement, but another one might be the current conversation about two federations in the Bay Area, or three. To presume that inherited structures are the only way that it's meant to be is to abdicate our voice in shifting it towards what it could be. In other words, if we don't dream out loud about a healthy system that supports all Jewish permutations, and we just accept inherited structures, both institutional and religious, it can sometimes be both, what are we? So I'm not going to point to Rabbi Kelman's quote, which is text 5, but it's about some of that question. It's about the status of gay and lesbian couples in our shul. This was from 95. Not going to point to that, but it's online and very, very important to read. I will, however, point, and this is the last text that I'm going to share, but there's a lot more to share, to text 6, which is from the Journal of the Steinhardt Foundation. The book, it's called Contact. You can find it online. There's some wonderful essays in this. This is by Bill Robinson in an essay called Authentic Jewish Education. To live authentically is to be the author of your own life. Lionel Trilling in Sincerity and Authenticity describes how authenticity comes from the Greek word authentio, which means, quote, to have full power over, but also to commit a murder. When we become the authors of our own lives, we have in essence murdered our former selves. In authentic Jewish education, we will recognize and honor those who have wrestled with Judaism before us. We also metaphorically kill Judaism every day by taking it apart, turning it upside down, and pulling it inside out, constantly creating the new while remembering the past. Now, he says it very violently. This is not the language that I use. Right? It is an incredible rupture-full language to use when the question of progressive Judaism within history comes up. But the question of what have I done when I introduce change is actually very important. And I use this text emphatically because every time we suggest a change, we are doing just that. We are changing. There is continuity. But Rabbi Akiva wouldn't understand anything I'm saying. He wouldn't recognize me because of the way I look. He wouldn't know what I'm talking about. He would reject some of my theology as authentically Jewish. He would wonder why I'm comfortable living outside of the land of Israel. I don't know that he would know that we were a shul. And yet, we quote him every time we daven. I'm going to use one more text. I said I wouldn't, but I need to use one more. So this Monday night, Rabbi Eli Spitz is going to be speaking here at the Tivot Shalom. He's the author of a book called Does the Soul Survive? He's also the author of a new book that just came out called Healing from Despair. He has gone through his own bouts of depression, and this is a Jewish wisdom response to depression. And he is incredibly, incredibly holy as a person and a wonderful teacher. So if you have the chance to be here Monday night, 7:30, please, please come. We love some of his books, but that's not the reason to be here, although he'll appreciate you buying it. One of the reasons that I need to be near him is this text that he wrote. He's the author of a legal response, a tshuva, in the conservative movement, which was accepted in the year 2000, about the question of mamzerut. A mamzer is someone who is born from incest or from adultery, and in classic Jewish thinking, legal thinking, and in biblical thinking, in terms of the value judgment, a mamzer, meaning the child born from incest or from adultery, can never marry a Jew. Can never marry someone who's perhaps a mamzer. Can only marry someone who is a mamzer, and their children can never marry Jews either. What did that child do, besides being born? We don't visit the sins of the parents on the children, even though the biblical text that we did on the pink sheet suggests that sometimes we do. Right? But it is not moral. Well, who says? I'm contesting the morality of the explicit text of the Torah. Here's what Elie Spitz writes, and this is just a paragraph. You can find this one online too. When a law of Torah conflicts with morality, when the law is, quote, unpleasant, we are committed to find a way to address the problem. As a halachic movement, we look to precedent to find the tools with which to shape Torah. For the most part, we rely on strategies of old. At the same time, we are willing to do explicitly what was largely implicit in the past, namely to make changes when needed on moral grounds. It is our desire to strengthen Torah that forces us to recognize explicitly the overriding importance of morality, a morality which we learn from the larger unfolding narrative of our tradition. Morality trumping inherited halacha is quite heretical in classic Jewish thinking. This is a codified work of Jewish law. In that now canonized text that Rabbi Spitz wrote, and which was accepted by the Supreme Court-ish of conservative Judaism called the Committee of Jewish Law and Standards, there is now a text which can be used as a precedent which says that morality trumps inherited tradition when inherited tradition is deemed immoral by a modern religious body. It is canonized heresy, or it is healthy internal revolution. It uses the word halakha, Jewish law, in a way that doesn't say we reject Torah. That would be that rupture that we could have had in the earliest rabbinic text. God is not great. This doesn't say Torah is not Torah. This says Torah now includes morality. It is an internal trump card in the Jewish legal system.
Basic, it's not just including this. Morality is part of Judaism. One of the most important.
I'm not disagreeing with you, but the sentence that morality is basic to Judaism is itself quite revolutionary. Maybe not in our lifetimes, but in the question of what Judaism has been allowed to evolve into, that was not always the presumption. I agree with you. I assert that. So is the relationship with people who aren't Jewish and other faith communities. The permutation of Judaism that we embody at the moment is not the permutation of Judaism that existed before. So we know we live in a dynamic Jewish environment, that our conception of conservative Judaism that we live here in this shul is radically different from the one that was born and then reborn by Solomon Schechter in the early 20th century. Because it wouldn't have included women rabbis at the very basic level. It wouldn't have changed the tzidur at all. Many things that we do today are not inherited tradition, and yet it is traditional. So I'll share with you one vignette and then we're done. The vignette is, I grew up with a mother who wears talit. Beautiful talit, actually. It's like a poncho with this beautiful stripy stuff. And as a child, I would play with her tallis strings. I would, you know, that's my Jewish soul. That's my childhood. So when I had a conversation with my father, who's a conservative rabbi, about what is traditional, I said, egalitarianism is traditional. He said, no, it's not. I was part of the generation that fought for it. It's not traditional. It's innovative. And I said, it's not innovative. I was a child playing with my mother's talis. It's traditional. I said, the question is, what is traditional in any moment, and what is outside of that context in any moment too? ultimately we have a lot of learning to do so that we can be part of the system that reevaluates itself. Because we are determined not to read anyone out. No one is judged for having a different belief here. We are not dogmatic. We don't judge people for having different practices because that's not what Judaism is about in our conception of it. The question is, how do we find our own authentic self as a people, as a community? What are the delineations that lead to halakha, that lead to the rules? How do we feel commanded by any of those rules personally? Because if they're aspirational values of our community, shouldn't they be things that we strive for? Those are really important questions to ask. So if we're determined not to read anyone out, we have to make sure we're not reading ourselves out by putting distance between what we say we believe as a community and what we strive for as individuals. That's not to judge anyone. I don't always live up to my own ideals. But it's my goal to. And I hope that we get there. I think we will. I think one day we will look at the Siddur and wonder about the possibilities of shift. But to do that, we have to make sure that the dynamism isn't the only part of the Judaism that we fight for. It has to be in the name of tradition, L'shem Shemayim. Thank you.